Welcome to the Chic Perspective Show. This is Elizabeth Gordon, and I am broadcasting live from our studio here in Atlanta, Georgia. Joining me today on the Heel to Heel We Rise Network are four of Atlanta's finest female attorneys, which I have the pleasure of bringing a very enlightening conversation with them to you today. So I want to welcome to the show Paige Arden Stanley, Heather Wright, Rebecca Preen, and Jackie Hutter. We have a wonderful roundtable here that I know you're going to enjoy. So first up, I'd like to introduce you to Ms. Paige Arden Stanley, who is an attorney at the law office of Paige Arden Stanley. Paige represents small business owners in a variety of industries and serves their general and local counsel needs, working with business clients on various stages of the development of their business in terms of inception and formation, as well as dissolution. She also litigates and is a frequent speaker on topics like estate planning and fundamentals in law. So, Paige, welcome to the show. I'm so glad to have you here. I'd like you to start off by telling our listeners a little bit about what made you start down the path of getting into law as a career choice?
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here this afternoon. And for me, it's actually been an interesting journey. I have a background in consulting, and I did that a number of years before going to law school. And after getting my law degree and going to work at a large firm for a number of years, and I got a lot of experience there, I decided that I really wanted to kind of get back to the roots, so to speak, and be able to interact with more clients, you know, on a day-to-day basis, and just really be able to, if I could, affect some change. So I made the decision to go and start my own law practice almost 2 years ago now. And as part of that, I'm able to serve small business owners in and around Atlanta in the state of Georgia.
Now, you practiced at Powell Goldstein, which is one of Atlanta's oldest and largest law firms, before starting your own practice. So how is having a small firm different than coming from a large established law firm?
Oh, it's very different. I am a solo practitioner at this time when I need assistance with paralegal related tasks, filing, management, administrative, on a as needed ad hoc basis, I will hire contract people. But the biggest difference is that, you know, due to the having less overhead and it just being myself primarily, I'm the one answering the phones and interacting with the clients on a day to day basis. And as a result, clients are getting, you know, an experienced attorney, but, you know, at a lesser hourly rate than what large firms typically have to charge.
Oh, absolutely. And as a small company, you know, you're very cognizant of the bottom line and getting the maximum value for your spend. And there's a lot of legal issues that companies run into. What are some of the things that you do for clients?
Well, I actually, Elizabeth, I do a variety of things. I kind of consider myself outside general counsel for small business owners. And that's in a variety of industries my clients come from. And I do things from helping them set up, deciding the entity that they need to have for their business, creating the requisite documents related to the formation. And then at each stage of the development of their company, if they're taking on independent contractors, employees, maybe a partner, I'm there advising them and working to negotiate and draft those types of documents. I do have a background in business litigation from my days at Powell Goldstein, so I keep an eye on, you know, knowing what kind of the hot buttons are and red flags when I'm drafting documents. So I kind of think that positions myself and my firm a little bit differently maybe than strictly transactional attorneys.
And you and I had an interesting conversation regarding the evolution of social media and how that's starting to infiltrate into the world of the legal system, which hasn't yet quite caught up to, you know, what's going on in the internet and social media landscape. Any tips or comments that you can make regarding this? Because I know it's a real interesting trend that has caused a lot of unique challenges lately.
Oh, it absolutely has. And I absolutely can make a couple of tips along those lines. One of the things that we're seeing, especially with respect to non-competition and non-solicitation agreements, is if an employee leaves a business and goes to work for another company and had signed, you know, a non-competition, a non-solicitation type of document, even things that may in that person's mind be benign, you know, posting on LinkedIn, everybody should come work here, or going after maybe some prior employees, you know, coworkers, talking to them about the business. Those kinds of things may on their face not seem like a big deal to the person doing it, but I guess the takeaway from what I'm saying, just to kind of keep this brief, is people need to be really careful with what they are posting, be it on LinkedIn, Facebook, you know, if they're Twitter, you know, have a Twitter account. And if they have signed, you know, those types of documents, they need to really understand what the parameters are of what's appropriate and what isn't. And talking to their, you know, their new employer in their business, so everybody's on the same page.
And I know that you do some litigation, but however, as your client's attorney, probably work more towards advising to avoid going to litigation in the first place by doing certain things right, like getting proper organizational documents set up front, making sure that you check employees' non-compete agreements, or understanding how to work with independent contractors. What are some of the pitfalls that if you don't have good legal counsel, you might find yourself faced with if you haven't done things right in the first place?
Well, I can give you a couple of examples. When we're talking about formation documents, I have actually handled matters where a couple of business partners, you know, they form a, you know, an LLC, perhaps on their own through the Secretary of State website. Maybe they get something on LegalZoom, maybe they don't. But in a situation where there's two or more owners of a business, an operating agreement is critical. And I have received numerous calls from people that find themselves in situations where they thought they were going to be, you know, in business forever, so to speak, or, you know, until retirement. And things went south and they don't have a proper exit strategy. And what ends up happening, and actually I handled a matter last summer where we had to settle a pretty sizable dispute because they didn't have, you know, all their I's dotted, T's crossed, so to speak, and they're for the situation they found themselves in, these people really needed to kind of exit part ways. And there was, you know, a disagreement in terms of what that was going to cost.
And so if you're not prepared, you know, and you don't think through all the scenarios, definitely you need to know where to turn and how to get out of these kinds of situations that you might have gotten yourself into thinking that it was going to have a rosy ending.
Absolutely. And it's hard for people to know what they don't know. And that's where it's really important for people to talk with, you know, experts, be it a CPA if there's tax issues, you know, an attorney for the legal piece. And, you know, some of the do-it-yourself websites and, you know, looking at a draft from, you know, some Google search on the internet, you know, it's not state specific to Georgia. Laws change. We've had, you know, just with the recent election, you know, November 2nd, you know, the House Bill 173 passed, and now non-compete and non-solicitation in Georgia is different for those types of agreements that are executed, you know, after January 1st of this year. So it's really important to recognize limitations and know that you can turn to people to ask those kinds of questions.
Well, that's why I am thrilled to death that I've gotten the opportunity to get to know you. And I would certainly encourage all of our listeners to check out your website, which is stanleylawoffice.com. And Paige is also, the law office of Paige Argent Stanley is also on Facebook. So you can become a fan there. And thank you so much. I'm going to turn now over to our next guest, Ms. Heather Wright, who is the founder and owner of The Wright Firm, LLC, which is a boutique civil law practice founded in 2005. The Wright Firm represents individuals and businesses in business law, family law, civil litigation, and mediation. And Heather's current practice includes corporate representation and consulting as well as commercial contracts, liability disputes, personal injury, family law. Man, there are a lot of things that people need an attorney for. Heather, welcome to the show. I'm so glad to have the opportunity to get to know you. Why don't you tell us a little bit about how you got started and how you became an expert in all these different areas?
Well, thank you, Elizabeth, for having me. And I, listening to Paige, it's like I think a lot of lawyers have the same story about how they came to be lawyers. I think I started just liking to argue with my parents. And I really enjoyed the law. I had very good teachers in high school and got exposed to legal procedure and constitutional law and just had a very big interest in it. And so after going to business school, I said, you know what, I think I'm going to go to law school, and just enjoyed it immensely. And then, like Paige, started my practice with a large firm doing litigation after clerking for a judge and being really exposed to a lot of different areas of law because of litigation. Litigators know how to argue in court, and then their clients need a lot of different things. So when you litigate cases, the great thing is you get to learn about each dispute, the type of contract, potentially the type of tort that's been involved, which for those out there that aren't lawyers, tort's just the fancy lawyer word for all the stuff that you hear about on the news, slip and falls and car accidents and all those personal injuries that we hear about. But just got involved in litigation and then started saying, well, why don't we tell our clients not to do this next time? And big firms don't always operate on that one-on-one. It's always a one-off through an insurance company. And so very similar story to Paige. I just thought, I just want to be able to grab the CEO and say, hey, we need to do this differently. And I think there's a lot of opportunity in the law for creativity. You don't hear that a lot, but there is.
Yes, and well, that's why I selected this eclectic panel, because I find that you guys have a very enlightened and creative view on what you can do with the law and how to make the law work to your client's favor. So, Heather, tell us a little bit more about who are your clients, what kind of companies and professionals do you serve?
Well, really, you jokingly said after reading the description of my firm that really you need a lawyer for a lot of different things at different times. And my clients are so varied. I mean, I have a company that does really intricate artistic metal fabrication all the way to CPA firms. So it's really about them being an expert at what they do and me being an expert at what I do and trying to help them make better decisions. What I tell clients from a litigator's perspective is the question that they don't ask that costs them $100,000 in litigation really might have cost them less than $1,000 if they'd have called the lawyer and just picked the lawyer's brain. And being a small firm and having the experience that I have, a lot of times the questions that clients ask don't really require 15 days of research. They require somebody that has enough wherewithal and understanding of how these situations work that you can make a good logical decision and know what the ramifications are of that decision or what the potential ramifications are. And so, I get to work with a lot of different companies, and that's sort of the fun side, because if you write the same contract over and over again, it can get pretty boring. I mean, you can slowly over time develop it to be the perfect contract or perfect operating agreement, but it's really getting to know the client's business and seeing what their needs are. And right now, the economy that we're in actually creates a great opportunity for creativity and letting companies try different things and sort of being there with them as they do that. It's pretty interesting.
Well, and I like that you really see a lot of the relationship side of the business in addition to just the words in the contract. And we were talking earlier before the show about some of the organizations in the community that you've become involved with and on the board of, and really gotten to know a lot of influential business people throughout the community. How has that area of your involvement been able to influence, you know, the growth of your practice?
Well, I think anytime you invest time in something, it can only benefit your business, whether it's your own personal growth or growth of your practice. I jokingly mentioned I just finished my year as president of the Buckhead Business Association, and the growth that I got both personally and business-wise was just immense. I think that you get to be exposed to a lot of different things. I mean, it's not every day that someone with my size practice, which is a solo practice, you know, is greeting Arthur Blank and talking to him at lunch about issues that we're dealing with in business today. And so, you know, anytime you can expose yourself to different things, I think as lawyers especially, you know, our experiences are part of what formulate our legal opinions. You know, every answer is not in a book. I used to joke with people, and I think the other lawyers at the roundtable here would agree, that people ask you all the time, is such and such legal? Well, we don't have a book that says yes or no. They'd actually try that in Louisiana, and that's why the law down there is pretty crazy. We have to think about the issues and kind of think through them, and it's more complicated than just, is something legal or isn't it legal? And that's what the fun of our job is actually realizing that it's about education. You really get to educate your clients about what their needs are and educate them about what the legal environment is and then help them make a better decision. I mean, that's what I pound into my clients all the time is, you know, my job is not to tell them yes or no on something. My job is to educate them and help them make what they think is the best decision.
I think that's a really interesting philosophy and kind of way of looking at the law that a lot of people don't necessarily realize that that's how it can work when you have the right legal advisor on your side, that you can find ways to make things work for you.
Yeah, I think that's really, you know, one of the reasons that my practice has developed into mediation, and I've spent a lot of time on that, is you just see things in litigation. I'm sure that every one of us sitting here could tell horror stories about clients that have just, you know, they've made a decision, they knew in their gut it wasn't right, but you really get that opportunity to help clients make better decisions. And usually when cases go to mediation, the reason I like it a lot better than litigation is the clients have an opportunity to make a decision. And, you know, what I tell people when I mediate, the very first thing I say when we get started is, you know, today the world is open to opportunity. When you go to court, there are other factors involved. There's evidentiary rules. There's the jury and their personal biases. There's the judge and how busy his calendar is or her calendar is. There's all of these other factors that you can't control, that you can't decide on. But when you're dealing with a good business lawyer or a good estate planner, you don't have to do everything in court. Everything doesn't have to have somebody make you do something. You can actually choose to do things. And that's really what I tell my clients all the time is, you know, we can choose to try this. And if it doesn't work, we'll try something else. And we can choose to try the next thing. And in litigation disputes, it's the same way. You can choose how you're going to behave. And I think that maybe that's why sometimes lawyers in the past have gotten a bad rap, is we kind of forget that that's, everything doesn't have to be set in stone.
Well, and so much of business is about continuing to make decisions and then change the decisions that you've made and rethink decisions and restructure things. And so having a trusted legal advisor is so critical to navigating the path of business and all the avenues that it takes us. So, Heather, your website, I wanted to make sure we mentioned the Right Attorneys. .net is the best way for people to find you as well. I'm going to turn now over to Rebecca Preen, who is with Counsel to Creativity. Rebecca, also an attorney, and she works actually with creative types, hence the name. And we've been talking a little bit about creativity and the law, Heather. So I'm sorry, Rebecca. Welcome to the show. First of all, hi there. How are you? Let's talk a little bit about your practice. Why don't you explain kind of more what kind of cases you do, what you help clients with, and what types of businesses you work with?
Sure. Heather, when she spoke about creativity and about education, it was really like the perfect kind of segue or lead in, because that those two things and strategy are really what my practice is about. I work with primarily more right-brained, creative professionals and people and businesses really on developing a strategy to use their creativity, use it as intellectual property to grow their business, to really make a business around it, or to step up the level of the business that they have.
Okay. Because a lot of times when somebody has an entrepreneurial idea or they've developed some kind of creative thing, they've got an idea, but they're not quite sure, how do I turn that into a tangible asset of value? And that's sort of what you help them with?
Yeah, I can start to help them with that. I work with people, you know, on their business models, how they're going to generate revenue from their creativity. I don't know what else to say, but I do a lot of educating about what the various types of intellectual property are, and then how you can use contracts to leverage those.
What is your background, and how did you gravitate to this aspect of the law of helping people to create intellectual property and structure contracts to create business value from them?
Interestingly enough, my background is also in litigation. I started.
We've got a lot of arguers in the room. I'm waiting
for
the fight to break out.
You know, you ask why I became a lawyer, and I kind of go blank and think, oh, it was because, you know, I was very opinionated, and it was pretty much, you know, my parents kept saying, oh man, she's got to go to law school, or she might not have a place.
That's so funny. So, my parents used to say that about me, but I gravitated to consulting instead, more of the debate issue.
I was going to do one of three things when I graduated from college: get a PhD in history, go to journalism school, or go to law school. The history PhD was going to make me by myself and not talking enough. Any of you who know me know that I like to chat. I'm kind of in the perfect situation right now. Spend most of my days chatting with clients or with new clients, or networking and really working in the idea, in the world of ideas, which is really what I wanted. That was not where I was when I started law school or when I finished law school. I started at a large firm in Boston named Goodwin Procter in their litigation department, worked almost primarily at that point in time on securities and securities fraud.
Interesting.
Interestingly enough, I then went to the First Circuit for almost 2 years and then to the 11th Circuit for another 2 years, which is how I landed in Atlanta. And like litigators, attorneys who work with appeals need to learn the facts and the law and the in-depth kind of understanding of the industry that's involved very quickly. And so I kind of thought afterwards, what am I qualified to do? I'm qualified to learn things very quickly, come to an understanding of things very quickly, which I think both, you know, both Paige and Heather spoke about. And then afterwards, my job afterwards was along similar lines. It was in an arbitration litigation group. And really, I had a lot of dissatisfaction with being an attorney. I was not fulfilled. I was very frustrated by the structure of it, by the day-to-day task. I always kind of felt like there was something more in it for me. And I slowly started to allow the other attorneys around me in my offices to know and understand that I was also an artist. I'm a painter, an oil painter, and a yoga teacher. And I
so
got
you have
surprisingly
this whole other
yeah,
side
and I got
of
to,
you.
I was really like very like okay, I got to keep my professional life over here and the part I really love about my life and myself over on the other side.
I
and
think
guess
a lot
what?
Of times, yeah, we compartmentalize
we do.
Or we're told that that's the way it's
and
supposed
I was
to
told
be.
To be happy with that. I mean, even just with my family or like other mentors I had, it was like, well, you can do painting as a hobby. What's the problem? But I was very, you know, very dissatisfied. And so I was laid off when a slew of lawyers in Atlanta were laid off in the middle of 2009 and just decided that, you know, I had been given a chance early ahead of my, quote, rational plan to do what I wanted to do. And what I wanted to do was to work with other creative people like me who wanted businesses around what they love to do. And so that's really who I get up every morning and work with and who I meet when I go out to network. And that is the most fun part of my job.
That's really cool that you've been able to create a perfect career and a perfect practice to serve both your skill set as well as what really brings you a lot of joy. So you mentioned the role of mentors throughout, you know, this process. What role have mentors and advisors played for you in helping to help you understand, you know, what you're capable of or what you can do?
You know, it's becoming clear that they're ever present right now. And when you become an entrepreneur, it feels even more important to have mentors. And I've been lucky that they've crept up in the right place at the right time, the right people. One of them is sitting in this room, Jackie Hutter. So I would say, yeah, it's always great to have someone who's either gone that way before you or is right there in it with you, who brings either a more seasoned or a different perspective to bounce things around about, or to be able to say, you know, I'm coming up at this juncture with my business. Like right now I have capacity issues. You know, how do I work through that? How do I handle that? So, the sort of formal structures that were put in place for mentors at my law school and at my job, those didn't really work out for me. But once I got really able to kind of talk to people about who I was and what I was doing and what I was excited about, that's when the mentor started showing up.
That's a very interesting
story. And it's the one thing I was afraid to do. Because you network with lawyers, you think you're supposed to fit into this lawyer thing. And I thought everyone would be like, how are you going to make a living out of that? But once I kind of got over that, I was like, well, I'm either going to by telling people about it or I'm not going to at all. People responded.
Well, so what would you say, you know, to sum up kind of a philosophy that you've been able to put together based on some of these experiences and seeing how your own career has evolved? Is there kind of a particular mantra or philosophy that you subscribe to at all?
You know, I really listen to my intuition. And the times when I have not, when I have known something like wasn't a right fit for me, or I was continuing to go down a career path that I thought I was supposed to do because everyone else did it and because I had the credentials to do it. Somebody said something great to me, and I'm sure you've all heard it before, but you know, just because you can doesn't mean you should or that you have to. And I spent a lot of time doing what I could do because I was capable of doing it and I was good at it. You know, I was very, very capable lawyer. I still am a very capable lawyer,
well, exactly.
But I mean, in a different context.
That happens a lot. I mean, with such a high achieving, highly intellectual, highly talented people, you can do anything. And then, you know, figuring out what really you want to do
and
or
I would
what you
say,
should be doing.
Heather just reminded me, a lot of fear around money, thinking that money only came through one established path. And so I would encourage people to, you know, try and seek people out who are making a living doing what it is that they're excited about, because you can build a business around it when you find those mentors and the resources and people who've done it before.
Well, and let's bring on Miss Mentor herself, Miss Jackie Hutter, who is the principal of the Hutter Group, IP Business Strategy. Now, you said in here, this is your day job, the one that actually pays the bills, and you have plenty of other jobs up your sleeve as well. But general counsel and chief bottle washer at the startup energy company EventTech, I want to hear about that one as well. Jackie, tell us first about your law practice and your self-described path as a recovering patent attorney.
Well, I don't have a law practice. I am purely a consultant these days. My license plate says unlawyer. The surprising part about that is that it was still available.
Nobody had snatched that up.
Which is kind of sad when you think about it.
Now in 2009 and 2010, you were named one of the 250 top IGists in the world by Intellectual Assets Management magazine. So how did you, you know, become the unlawyer now?
Well, I was, I have a very similar background to these ladies, I started as a litigator actually at Powell Goldstein many years ago, and then realized I liked to go home. and realized that if I continued to be a litigator at Powell Goldstein, that was not an objective that was readily attainable. So I said, you know what? I went to law school to be a patent lawyer, and patent lawyers don't work that hard. Well, relatively speaking. So I jumped out of litigation practice and became a geeky patent lawyer and basically did prep and pros, that is filing patent applications, prosecuting them before the patent office, opinion work, occasional litigation support as the geeky patent lawyer who needed to support the litigators because they don't understand all this geeky stuff that we did. And got very wealthy. Got made a partner, then a shareholder at a very prestigious firm here in Atlanta. And I woke up one day and I asked my husband, who's a historian. I said, you know, back in the old days, when people became masters at their craft in the guild, were they happy? In the meantime, I've got our kids in the back seat that I picked up at like 6:29 and, you know, 30 seconds, you know, right before daycare closed. And my husband said, you know, he thought for a second. He goes, you know what? No, they weren't happy, but they were rich. I went, okay, I'm rich and I'm not happy. So I jumped off of the walked away from the brass ring, had ostensibly reached the brass ring, was able to land a corporate gig at a major consumer products company, which was felt like home because I was a consumer products chemist when I was a scientist. And so had a lot of fun there, really got into the innovation space and working a lot with business people who, interestingly enough, were not stupid. A lot of patent attorneys have this thing because they only hang out with scientists and PhD types that, gee, business people don't hang around us because they're not smart enough to understand this really. And I'm only partially kidding. This is just literally,
I'm sure.
Yeah. The assumption was because we were never asked about business stuff, then must be that this stuff's too hard for business people. What I realized very quickly is being surrounded by Harvard MBAs and MIT MBAs and Chicago MBAs, and they were plenty smart. Actually, they were a lot smarter than I was. It's just that I needed to be able to talk to them in a language that made it relevant to their job every day. And that was a whole lot of fun, not, you know, stepping away from arguing with the patent office and actually figuring out how to create value for business. And a lot goes back to what Heather said about you wanting to grab the CEO and say, no, don't do that. That's just, I can save you so much money. And that was a huge, huge turning point for me when I realized I could actually make money for other people. And by making money for them, then naturally money would come to me. Whereas before, as a law firm shareholder, I thought only about my own business model, and it was all about the time that I was spending. And, you know, by definition, if I was getting paid all this money, I was creating value for them too. But in reality, it was very little. But as I put in the questions that I answered for you, I was pushed. You know, I lost my job. And why did I do this? Well, because I was pushed.
I think it takes for everybody to take that next leap.
And I was very well paid, and all of a sudden I wasn't very well paid anymore. Fortunately, I had a nice little parachute to cushion the landing a little bit. But I basically had to decide what I wanted to be when I grew up, and I realized that I wanted to help people on the front end. I didn't want to solve their problems after the fact. I wanted to help them create value on the front end and then, by definition, create value for myself.
Right. And, I mean, so much – it's interesting that you mentioned the language thing. I mean, the business has its own language. The law has its own language. And I think, you know, it's about bridging that gap and how do those languages work together and how can you use the law to then create value for your clients from an intellectual property standpoint. So as kind of an IP strategist, you work directly with your clients to help make sure they're making smart decisions going into business decisions in terms of planning, in terms of not wasting money. What are some of the things that you've seen people do that, you know, good legal counsel would have helped them avoid?
Well, I differentiate good legal counsel from strategic legal counsel. There is plenty of good legal counsel out there. We all, when we were doing litigation, were probably pretty darn good legal counsel. But there's a difference between solving problems after they occur and developing strategies, becoming aware and engaged with your client's business strategy. So one of the biggest mistakes I see people do, and it's time and time again, is to assume that because they have an invention or because they have something that they have come up with that's perhaps should be trademarked or something like that, is to automatically go to an intellectual property counsel. Lawyers don't get paid for saying no.
So they're always going to think it's a good idea for you to hire them.
Well, the question, their question is when you bring them an invention, for example, their concern is if it's patentable. They don't care, nor should they care, whether or not it supports your business goals. And it actually is not appropriate to do both of those things at once because there are two separate questions. And I don't know about you, but there are very few patent attorneys that I've ever met that I would want to balance my checkbook, let alone drive my long-term business goals. Hmm. They're totally different. The strategy and the execution are two different questions. I have found that I am much more, even though I got to the top of my profession, I was a brain surgeon to the extent that analogy is correct in the patent world, that my actual I create more value by being on the business side and understanding what people's business goals. And I have figured out a way that I can get paid to say no. That no, yes, you can get a patent, but no, you should not. But if the answer is yes, you should get a patent, then because I was the equivalent of a brain surgeon, I can get you to a high quality counsel who can do what you need to have done at a good rate and under appropriate circumstances. And that's another part of it too. I think that I'm really glad to have met the ladies sitting across from me, because now I can say, you know what, now I know somebody who I know to be strategic. And if she can't answer the question, she would treat me or my client the same way as if the dollars that need to be spent are their dollars. And I think that's the difference between the people around the table and the lawyer I used to be, is that I treat everybody's dollars like they're my dollars. In other words, I worry about other people's business and business model more than I worry about mine. And I assume that my business model will be taken care of because I treat people like that.
And that certainly is a unique philosophy, and it's interesting to hear how you've developed that over the course of a fantastic career, which now also you've got this other venture, Event Tech, and we're almost out of time, but mm-hmm. I wanted to just give you the opportunity to mention it briefly, and perhaps we'll have to have you come back on the show and talk a little bit more about the company, but give us kind of a sketch of...
Sure. Well, interestingly, I never would have had this opportunity had it not been because of social media. I'm a blogger and very well known, at least in the kind of insular world of IP strategy. I blog at ipassetmaximizerblog.com. And these gentlemen who had an invention were looking for – they knew that the existing paradigm of patent attorneys weren't right for what they needed. They needed much more strategic advice, and they found me on the through my blog, and I started consulting for them. And then, quite honestly, and I think that they would readily admit it, it became apparent that they needed a grown-up in the room. And I became that grown-up. And one day I said to him, I said, I've been telling people that I'm going to be general counsel for this company someday. He goes, and the CEO said, well, Jackie, we've been telling people for months you're our general counsel. So we're quite literally going to change the way you think about charging your cell phone, your iPhone, and your car, as a matter of fact. So more to come. We're yet to file our patent applications. That'll be coming soon. But I'm sure everybody at this table, let alone in this audience, would be thrilled to be able to charge your iPhone in a half an hour. We'll make that happen for you.
So some very exciting technological developments on the way. Well, I've got to tell you, the intellectual capital in this room right now is just absolutely astounding. It's been such a pleasure to have the opportunity to have the four of you on the show today. Like I said, we are almost out of time, so I want to go to our final segment, which is our chic tip. So we're going to go back around the room now again. And the chic tip just gives you the opportunity to kind of sum up somewhat of a lessons of advice from, you know, what's been a tremendous career that each of you have had. One piece of advice you'd offer to someone else who's maybe just starting down this kind of a career journey. So, Heather, actually, we'll start with you.
Great.
Took you by surprise there.
Awesome.
I know you're ready to share. I can just tell.
I'm
you've got a great one.
Ready to make something up on the fly. No, Paige had a great piece of advice about operating agreements. I think I'm going to go sort of more broad spectrum in this. Anytime you hire a professional, whether it's one of the four lawyers in this room or an accountant, my advice has always been to clients, you know, hire someone that you like, hire someone that you respect their competency. Hire someone that you say, I want to call that person on the phone and work with that person, and then worry about pricing, and then worry about their structure. Because I think something that Jackie said is very true, the paradigm of the big firm, a lot of people think because they have a firm that's multinational that that's what they need to find a good lawyer. And it's true, there are good lawyers in every firm in Atlanta. There are good lawyers in every firm in this country, frankly. But the fact of the matter is you want to find somebody that you want to work with. And the price tag may or may not matter, depending on the mindset of the person that you're working with. So I always tell my clients, you know, work with people you like and that you want to work with. So, and that goes for professionals. And sometimes I think clients think that, you know, a lot of people, small businesses, they don't know any lawyers. And so they don't know what a lawyer is supposed to look like. And you know what? You know, lawyers just think a little differently about situations. So I always tell my clients, you know, when I meet someone, I'm like, you know, give me a call if you ever need anything. If you don't, or even if you need a referral to a good plumber, you know, but if you like me, call me. If you don't, I know 100 other lawyers that do great work that I could refer you to, because if they don't like you, they won't call you and then they won't get the good advice that they need.
Well, that's a wonderful philosophy and a great piece of advice. So thank you for that. Paige Arden-Stanley, what would be your chic tip that you can pass on some of the lessons that you've learned over the years?
Well, Elizabeth, in thinking about this question, I'm going to go back to something that I said when I was on a panel to the University of Georgia School of Law, their second and third year law students, about being a solo practitioner. And I think it kind of applies not just to attorneys, but also to business owners as well. And at the end of the day, it is your reputation. And as a small business owner or a solo practitioner or whatever it is, and I think that it's very important to assess what your goals, your priorities are, listen to your clients' needs, and be responsive. I hear a lot that not, and I know none of the attorneys in this room do this, but attorneys don't always return phone calls timely. Attorneys don't respond to emails. And I have gotten work from clients because they were tired of that lack of attention that they were receiving. So kind of going back to what Jackie said earlier about treating everyone's dollars like my dollars, you know, I'm going to treat every client with, you know, respect and respond to them in a timely manner. And that's kind of my advice to people thinking about starting their own business, you know, the existing entrepreneurs out there. It's something that I'm always trying to remind myself of. It's my reputation at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And so guard it with that highest degree of integrity.
Absolutely.
And now over to Rebecca Preen, counsel to creativity. What would your chic tip be for us, Rebecca?
The first thing that comes to mind is not to put up a wall between your professional life and your other deep interests, that really your deep interests, what you care about, really does inform your professional life and can be the key to really having a meaningful business and enjoy it. So that's the first thing. I have a couple intellectual property law tips also. One is really don't depend upon the availability of a domain name. My clients again and again and again come with the understanding that somehow the domain registrar is related to the trademark office, and that because, you know, .gov was available but .com wasn't, that they can use this. And then they come up in violation, and then they come to me and they get a large bill along with a lot of frustration. That's the first thing. You cannot depend that you're not upon that domain registration for not violating somebody else's trademark, even if you decide that a trademark for the name is not the best thing for your company. And the second piece, thing that I see happen most common is that people come together to do a project in some kind of joint venture, and they never state who the ownership is of the new intellectual property. They state what's going to happen at that one time, what the compensation is for that kind of one time together, and they never state who owns what and what the rights are going forward. And they're can be a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of hurt feelings and tension when that's not done. So thanks for having me.
Excellent points. Jackie?
Well, I've first of all, with regard to dealing with a lawyer and selecting a lawyer, and also any lawyers who want to go a different route that like we in the room have done, I think what was the critical thing for me to be able to really be different and actually be successful, increasingly successful in this new thing of ISP strategy, which I'm pretty much making up along as I go along. But my Twitter name is at IP Strategist, so I guess it's better me than anybody else. But it was networking outside my comfort zone. As lawyers, we always hang out with other lawyers, and maybe that's why people say, I can't talk to lawyers. It's because it's like Mars and Venus. We never go hang out with regular people. We just go network with other lawyers. So I think that if you meet a lawyer at some place that you don't think lawyers should be, that's probably a really good thing. Because that means they're probably less of a lawyer than a lot of the lawyers that you've met. You may be able to communicate with them better. And if you are a lawyer wanting to break out of a big law firm or out of the traditional law firm practice, go hang out with people where it's not necessarily comfortable for you. It can be terrifying the first few times to show up at a meeting and have to have a conversation with a business person. But, you know, they're a lot more fun than lawyers. Trust me on that. And that's been just a wonderful experience. I would like to also give an intellectual property tip, excuse me, if you've already decided that you need a patent and you have this belief that if I just get a patent, I'm going to make $1 zillion, trust that the adage that build a better mousetrap and people will build a path to your door is absolutely wrong. There are gazillions of patents. More than 90% of patents are worthless. If all it took to be a patent, to be rich was a patent, there would be a lot more rich people and a lot fewer rich patent lawyers. So stop, think about it, and go talk to other people. Don't be afraid to talk to other people before you go talk to a lawyer, because chances are if you go immediately to a patent lawyer, you're going to have a really expensive plaque to put on the wall at the end of the day.
Well, I'm so thrilled that I've had the opportunity to introduce these wonderful women to you today. Again, we've got Paige Arden-Stanley, Heather Wright, Rebecca Preen, and Jackie Hutter. You're at thehuttergroup.com, and Rebecca's at counseltocreativity.com. We'll post all of that on the website. Thanks for tuning in for philosophy, proactive, and profitable tips on how you can use good, solid advice to continue to grow your business enterprise. Feel free to visit our website at flourishingbusiness.com and tune in next week for more Chic Perspectives. Thanks so much.